You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
You'll recognise my next guest. He used to be a regular on Classic 1027, his show called State of the Nation. And I recall sitting in a coffee shop at Melrose Arch with him when he had just started out at Bain to help design a remedy plan for the firm to implement to help restore the credibility of the company and oversee the firm's internal investigation into its role in the destruction of the South African Revenue Service. He resigned from the US consulting giant back in 2019, shortly into the job. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Cape Town Graduate School of Business in the Alan Gray Center for Values-Based Leadership. He lectures and conducts research in corporate responsibility, ethical leadership, and he's also a research fellow in the Center for Applied Ethics at Stellenbosch University, and has worked as a management consultant for over 15 years at various businesses, including Bain. He's also held senior executive roles at Old Mutual, at Rio Tinto in London, and RMB Corvest, Ethel Williams, South Africa, owes you and the whistleblowers who have come before you a debt of gratitude. But the decision to do the right thing, let's start there, to lift the lid on corruption, obviously comes at great costs, we hear, to whistleblowers. Let's start there. What have you experienced since your departure and willingness to expose what was going on inside Bain?
Michael, you know, I did not anticipate the high personal cost. I've actually read some of the research done on whistleblowers, and typically researchers say whistleblowers weigh up the benefit of going public and the cost to themselves. And I naively just thought there would be no cost to me because I'm doing the right thing, I'm revealing the truth, surely there can be no blowback to me. And that was just an underestimation on my part. Because what I didn't anticipate was the alienation I would feel. People just suddenly disappeared, Michael, amazingly. My business associates went silent. Law firms would not want to deal with me because of the people I implicated. Friends became skeptical. And suddenly you sort of felt isolated. Because you can understand it, right? There's a very cynical sense in South Africa about every time he's a good guy, you know, he's probably hiding something, or there's two sides to every story. Mm-hmm. And so I really felt a sense of alienation. But beyond that, I was gripped with fear. I received no death threats. And I keep telling people, you know, death threat isn't the only way you can be threatened. But I felt a sense of fear because I saw to what extent Bain was going to try and silence me. And, you know, when you extrapolate that, you say, well, if they're willing to try every legal avenue and it fails, if they're willing to threaten you financially and it fails, you know, where might this stop? And not just Bain, but also other associates. So I really was wrapped with a sense of fear, which impacted my health desperately and impacted my family in a very, very sad way.
That is remarkable and certainly very sad and chilling a recollection of the personal experience of a whistleblower. And as you say, Ethel, we read about it. You, as someone who lectures on ethical governance, learn about this kind of thing in textbooks all the time. But to actually experience this kind of persecution and marginalization firsthand and to go through it, it must be quite something.
You know, Michael, and sorry to interrupt you there, I discovered that there is no legal protection for whistleblowers in South Africa. Now, just pause there. That's a bizarre thing to say, right? When we are trying to fight corruption, you know, I loved how Judge Zondo said that at least half of the evidence at the Zondo Commission would not have been heard if not for whistleblowers. Everyone's been patting me on the back, sort of saying, "Yeah, well done, Apple, thank you." And I think it's sincere, and I appreciate that. But at the same time, I feel that society then sort of pats you on the back, but then stabs you in the back because there's no legal protection. Mm. There's no support.
Mm. Johan van Lochrenberg, just to add on to that, is someone who shares those sentiments as well, and is someone who is bravely crusading on inside this entire SARS story and pursuing doggedly those whom he believed wronged him. And we'll come to that because it is part of your sort of restorative justice-based approach for firms to first admit that these are real people that were wronged through what happened in the unfolding events at SARS. But I just want to find out, I mean, based on your experience and your position, you assisted the Nugent Commission with their investigation, you submitted the statement to the Zondo Commission, and you gave evidence at the Zondo Commission as well. How did your appointment to this role at Bain first come about?
I had a long history with Bain. You know, I joined Bain in the 1990s in the U.S. And worked with Bain over the years. I was appointed as a partner at Bain in 2009 and then left. But in 2018, at the start of the Nugent Commission, when it became evident that Bain was involved in the damage to SARS, that's when Bain then called me to rely actually far less on my consulting experience, but far more on my corporate ethics and corporate responsibility expertise. And the idea was, Michael, and this, you know, this I sincerely believed, was that Bain really wanted to do the right thing. They wanted to make amends. And so I was quite happy to lend my credibility and my skills to them to work through this process. But sadly for me, that turned out to be an insincere claim. And I felt, you know, late into 2019, that in fact I was being used as part of the cover-up.
And it was in that moment where you said, well, I simply cannot continue to be part of what is ostensibly seen to be a cover-up. And I want to skip ahead to that because what we see here is the head of the local office of Bain in South Africa, Vittorio Masani, and he disclosed to the Nugent Commission that he had multiple meetings with former President Jacob Zuma between 2012 and 2014, the first of which was arranged on the 11th of August of 2012 by Telkom CEO Sipho Maseko. And that meeting was also attended by Mr. Ndlovu. Now, according to your statement to the Zondo Commission, Masani spoke widely and proudly of his proximity to Zuma. Can you just give some insight into the context that these kinds of braggadocio-type comments were made by Masani?
Well, Masani saw nothing wrong with his close relationship with former President Zuma. You know, these meetings that he talked of, certainly the 12 that Bain admit to, and I think it's much higher, I think it approximates 20, were all behind closed doors, after hours, in the president's residence. So these weren't even in Masani's diary as, you know, meeting the president. These were, you know, there were code words and code names in it. But there was the sense he was proud of this. He told me directly that he socialized with the president. So it talks to an intimacy. This was not just a, you know, Bain tries to portray the Masani's meetings with the president as marketing meetings, which, you know, at the commission I said was just clearly absurd. These were, there was an intimacy, there was a relationship here. Masani was part of this inner circle. That, you know, I think Bain became Zuma's consultant of choice, which is why Zuma turned to Bain to help them think about implementing the ANC's election manifesto. Now, Michael, no management consulting firm gets involved in the political activities of this sort. No normal management consulting firm meets with the president of any country with that frequency, let alone a president who's wrapped up in corruption allegations as President Zuma is.
And if you look at the links here, if you join the dots to assist in entering the public sector, Bain entered a business development and stakeholder management contract, as it was termed, with Ambrobright, known as Kanoboya Consulting, and I've got the SIPSI number in front of me here. Now, Ambrobright had two directors, namely Duma Kude Ndlovu, who's the Ndlovu that I mentioned earlier, well-known businessman in the entertainment and TV business, and a close friend of Zuma, and Mpumelelo Njabulo Ngema. Now, Ambrobright was also co-owned by creative artist one Mr. Mandla Kanozulu. And if you look at it, there is a connection here to the former Minister of Police, Nathi Nhleko. What is that connection?
As far as I understand it, Michael, and certainly according to Mr. Kanozulu's personal website, he was an advisor to the Minister of Police. There's also a string of emails where Bain is facilitating a meeting between South African police senior generals and Italian counterparts. And there again, amongst the attendants, is Mr. Kanozulu. So there definitely was a connection there. You know, and this Ambrobright contract and the work that Mr. Ndlovu was supposedly doing, again, Bain presented as they were a consulting firm that were offering business advice. It was so obvious from the evidence that I've got, that I presented to the Zondo Commission, you know, the internal emails in Bain made very clear that this was really just Mr. Ndlovu introducing Bain to the president and other cabinet ministers to gain insight into what was happening in government. Insight, by the way, which was non-public, that Bain used for its commercial advantage.
Yeah, I mean, in breach of all kinds of laws there as well.
And,
I mean, if we look at this, Bain acknowledged these meetings, as you say, in a public statement, but said there were only 12. You reckon that there are at least 20. But you further confirmed that the global leadership of Bain was all aware of the meetings with Zuma, and it was well known that this relationship with Ndlovu and Amber Bright was to create connections with Zuma and other politically connected people. How can you be so sure that the global leadership knew of this?
Michael, everything I said at the Zonda Commission, and I've been saying in interviews, is based on documents I've got. These documents, I did not create. All of these documents I got from Bain or from Baker McKenzie, who were supposedly the independent investigators, but who were also advising Bain. So when I make a statement that says Bain's global head of legal knew about what the intention of the Amber Bright contract was, it's because I've got emails in front of me where the head of legal says so to the head of marketing, or he says so to another senior executive in Bain. There is not a single part of my testimony which is my conjecture. It's literally all documents and emails produced by Bain. And because Bain has tried to sort of portray Masoni as this lone wolf, they knew that Amber Bright wasn't a legitimate business, right? The director of finance in London raised all those red flags about the fact there was no financials ever filed by Amber Bright. SARS seemed to say that their tax certificate was fraudulent. So there were senior people across Bain who would raise red flags, who knew this was problematic, and yet it went ahead. Now, my question has been, if your head of legal globally for a multinational firm says there's a problem and he's overridden, who could possibly override someone that senior? And so, obviously, for me, went up all the way to the top of his organization.
Now, Athol, considering all of this, do you believe that Bain can be the one to come clean here? Surely the law has to take its course and prosecutions must follow based on the evidence adduced. Because I know you have advocated for the firm to just acknowledge and engage, firstly, those it wronged at SARS and to admit that it was in the wrong. I can imagine there are many at SARS who would welcome that as a first step. But what did Bain make of that suggestion when you first raised it?
Michael, there was always a division. There were divided opinions within Bain between what the legal people were driving at and what I tried to drive at. So my belief is the criminal justice system must take its course, but that isn't complete justice. Bain still had caused harm in society, in our society, and needs to make reparations for that. So in a way, I was saying legal plus reparations. What the legal team was saying was, no, we can't do reparations because that means we're admitting things which undermine our legal position. And so even when I was a partner at Bain, brought in to drive this remedy plan, there was that tension there. And in the end, that tension had caused me to leave because the legal guys basically said they were most worried about a Department of Justice prosecution in the U.S., if they even spoke to SARS. I mean, I was actually barred from speaking to SARS because I wanted to engage with SARS about remedy, and the legal people within Bain barred me from doing that because of their concern about the U.S. Authorities.
And it's so important. I mean, you touched on such a key point there, Athol. Right now, Edward Keyswater, the current SARS commissioner, is trying to rebuild after this project to repurpose the receiver. And really, that's what this all boils down to. You know, I'm reminded of what the issue of repurposing is all about. The concept of repurposing, it's been described by the Public Affairs Research Institute, PERI, as the organized process of reconfiguring the way in which a given state institution is structured, governed, managed, and funded so that it serves a purpose different to its formal mandate. And that certainly fits within the definition of the way in which SARS was captured and repurposed to benefit a specific group of individuals linked to, in particular, former Commissioner Tom Moyani. And in order to undo this, there has to be some kind of TRC-type moment. What would you like to see happen from here?
Firstly, I think that Perry description is brilliant. It's actually a brilliant description. And I think we need to remember just the nature of the damage that's done to an organization when it is repurposed. But to your question, Michael, I still would love to see Bain do the right thing. And by the right thing, it has to be two things. One, it's got to make full disclosure of what it knows about what happened at SARS and other SOEs, by the way. Bain worked at Telkom, they worked at the IDC, they worked at the PIC, they worked at SAA. Baker McKenzie's investigation covered all of those. So step one has to be them coming clean in terms of what happened there. Because I was certainly told by Baker McKenzie that what happened at Telkom was far more embarrassing for Bain than what happened at SARS. So we need to unearth that. Secondly, it's only after they make full disclosure do I really want them to make real reparations, be sincere about it. You know what's the strange thing, Michael? The last 2 years that Bain's been hiding and dodging and ducking, the cost to them is probably far more to their business, to their brand, or to the legal fees they've paid than if they had actually just stepped up, done the right thing at the outset. So I still think it's not too late. I still would like to see Bain make proper reparations. But the longer they go on with this hiding and obfuscation, at some point, I think we're going to just say, look, these guys need to be punished because we've given them a chance and they're not taking it.
Bottom line, Athol Williams, Senior Lecturer at the University of Cape Town, Graduate School of Business in the Alan Gray Center for Values-Based Leadership. Athol, thank you for doggedly pursuing this. I know you are going to be cross-examined by Bain as well. It'll be interesting to see that. I was watching when Tom Moyani put it to you via counsel at the commission that you were a disgruntled witness, and you responded by saying, damn right I'm disgruntled. I think the entire country is disgruntled at what we've seen happen to this great country over the last decade of state capture. And there is a great deal of support. We now need to your earlier point, ensure that we provide real support to the whistleblowers and have a look at the legislation, which is due for reform. Thank you.